Model Test 14.
Section A. Mini Lecture.
In this section, you will hear a mini lecture. You will hear the mini lecture once only. While listening to the mini lecture, please complete the gap-filling task with no more than 3 words for each gap. Make sure the word or words you fill in is or are both grammatically and semantically acceptable. You may use the blank sheet for note-taking. You have 30 seconds to preview the gap-filling task. Now, listen to the mini-lecture. When it is over, you will be given 3 minutes to check your work. Good morning, everyone. In today's lecture on British history, I would like to relate to you an inside story of Queen Mary. That is, how she was brought up to the throne and how it was going. At the beginning, King Henry VIII had plans for his grandniece, the infantry Mary. He wanted her to marry his son Edward and serve the ancient ties between Scotland and France. On July 1, 1543, Scottish nobles who were allied with the English king signed a treaty agreeing to the marriage. But Mary's mother, Marie of Guise, was a shrewd stateswoman, and she had plans of her own. Most of Scottish considered England an enemy. Both France and England wanted to make Scotland a dependent state to their countries. England had tried repeatedly to take control of Scotland, if for no other reason than that it, too, considered England an enemy. The French-Scottish alliance committed the two nations to helping each other against England aggression. Meanwhile, Marie of Guise and Cardinal David Beaton worked to have Mary crowned Queen of Scotland and France to the next level. This would be through a marriage between Mary and King Henry II's eldest son, the Dauphin Francis. Mary's uncles, the brothers of Marie of Guise, aided in the discussions. The Scottish Parliament, which preferred an alliance with France to any connection with its arch-enemy England, consented to the marriage. Then, Mary's life had gone to another page. Mary was sent to France in August 1548, both for her own safety and to prepare for the ceremony. Then, with France's help, the Scots were able to defeat the England. Mary was educated at the French court in a manner befitting a queen. Treated as a member of the royal Valois family, she was surrounded by extravagance, art, culture, Catholicism, and her influential uncles. Her closest companion was her future husband, the sickly Francis, for whom she felt genuine affection. Before her marriage, Mary signed official promises to safeguard the liberties of Scotland. Many historians believe that she also signed 3 secret documents in which she gave the Kingdom of Scotland to France if she did not produce an heir. In April 1558, almost 10 years after her arrival in France, Mary married Francis. Her father-in-law boldly proclaimed the couple the King and Queen of England, even though Elizabeth I ascended to the throne that same year. According to England's succession laws, Mary had no legal claim to the throne. Upon Henry II's death the following year, Francis became King of France and Mary Queen. She now officially wore 2 crowns. And there comes the return of Mary. A thick fog hugged the ship sailing into harbor on August 19, 1561. 18-year-old Mary, Queen of Scots, was returning home. She had been away for 13 years. Mary was returning to a land torn by civil war. After Mary's husband Francis died in December 1560, her Protestant half-brother, Lord James Stuart, invited her to rule Scotland. If Mary did not promote Catholicism publicly, he said, the lords would allow her to practice her religion privately. They hoped that Mary would convert to Protestantism. At first, Mary went along with the lords and allowed Protestantism to continue as the official religion of Scotland, while she herself remained Catholic. She probably thought that once she gained enough political support, she could restore Catholicism to Scotland. Many Scots, she knew, still believed in the old faith. If the foggy weather on her arrival dismayed Mary, the warm welcome she received must have cheered her. An eyewitness noted how the Queen's beauty, youth, and stately carriage excited the throngs who turned out to see her. They lighted joyful bonfires that night and serenaded the Queen with psalms. On the first Sunday after her return, however, Scottish nobles saw a priest preparing to celebrate Mass and tried to disrupt the service. James had to block them at the chapel door. At a ceremony a few days later, a child gave Mary a Bible in England. Mary was shocked to receive this reminder of the importance Protestants put on reading Scripture. For 4 years, Mary kept her promise not to make any alteration or innovation of the state of religion. She even warred against a powerful Catholic lord who challenged her loyalty to her half-brother James. Further, she arrested an archbishop for saying Mass. At the same time, however, she secretly looked for a husband, preferably a Catholic ruler of a strong military power. With the help of someone like the Crown Prince of Spain, for instance, she might bring Scotland back into the Catholic fold. She might also gain the throne of England, where many Catholics did not consider Elizabeth the legitimate ruler. But Mary's quest for a foreign alliance failed. In 1565, a new opportunity knocked. Mary's cousin, Henry Stuart, Lord Darnley, returned from England to his father's estate in Scotland. Darnley was Catholic. Like Mary, he was descended from the sister of Henry VIII and had a strong claim to the English throne. Even better, he was tall, young, and handsome, and he shared Mary's love for dancing, playing the lute, horseback riding, and hawking. In July, over the objections of her council, Mary wed Darnley. That fall, they chased their opponents, including James, out of Scotland. Mary must have felt that, at last, she was really queen, free to form her own policies. The fog that greeted her arrival had finally lifted. That's it for today. Thank you for listening. Now, you have 3 minutes to check your work. This is the end of Section A mini-lecture.
Section B, interview.
In this section, you will hear one interview. The interview will be divided into two parts. At the end of each part, five questions will be asked about what was said. Both the interview and the questions will be spoken once only. After each question, there will be a 10-second pause. During the pause, you should read the four choices of A, B, C, and D, and mark the best answer to each question. You have 30 seconds to preview the questions. Now, listen to part one of the interview.
Good morning, listeners. Today we are very glad to have Joanna Watson from Cambridge University to discuss with us the origins of Indo-European languages. Nice to meet you, Joanna.
Very pleased to meet you.
As we all know, Indo-European languages have got the same ancestor.
The traditional view goes like this. An Ur language, ancestor to all Indo-European languages, was spoken by nomadic horsemen. They lived in what is now Western Russia, north of the Black Sea, near the beginning of the Bronze Age. As these mounted warriors roamed over greater and greater expanses, they conquered the indigenous peoples and imposed their own Proto-Indo-European language, which evolved in local areas into the European languages we know today.
This is a quite reasonable explanation, isn't it?
It seems reasonable in itself, but in recent years, many scholars, particularly archaeologists, have become dissatisfied with the traditional explanation. The starting point of the problem of the origins of Indo-European is not archaeological, but linguistic.
What do you mean?
Well, when linguistics looks at the languages of Europe, they quickly find that these languages are related. The connections can be seen in vocabulary, grammar, and phonology. For instance, the numbers from 1 to 10 are quite similar in several Indo-European languages. There are significant similarities among many European languages and also Sanskrit, the language of the earliest literary text of India. But those languages, such as Chinese or Japanese, are not members of the same family.
Interesting. Can you give us a typical example?
Sure. Take the Romance languages as an example. Even to someone with no knowledge of Latin, the profound similarities among Romance languages would suggest that they were derived from a common ancestor. It would be possible to reconstruct many of the characteristics of the original proto-language. In much the same way the branches of the Indo-European family could be studied and a hypothetical family tree constructed.
So Indo-European languages do have a common ancestor.
That's true, and we call it Proto-Indo-European. This is the tree approach to the explanation of the origin of Indo-European languages. The basic process represented by the tree model is one of divergence. When languages become isolated from one another, they differ increasingly, and dialects gradually differentiate until they become separate languages.
I see. So divergence is the main tendency in language evolution.
This is the end of part one of the interview. Questions 1 to 5 are based on what you have just heard.
Question 1. What's the main topic of this interview?
Question 2. Who created the common ancestor of Indo-European languages?
Question 3. from which aspect can we see the connections of languages of Europe?
Question 4. Which language has significant similarities with European languages?
Question 5. What do we call the common ancestor of Indo-European languages?
Now, listen to part 2 of the interview.
Divergence is by no means the only possible tendency. Some scholars introduced a wave model in which linguistic changes spread like waves, leading ultimately to convergence, that is, growing similarity among languages that were initially quite different.
While divergence indicates tendency of differentiating languages, convergence means similarity of languages.
Right. Besides that, most linguists think primarily in terms of linguistic family trees. They find it necessary to construct some explicit models of how language change might occur according to a process-based view.
Have they formed some models?
So far, there are four main classes of models. The first is the process of initial colonization by which an uninhabited territory becomes populated. Its language naturally becomes that of the colonizers. The second are processes of divergence, such as the linguistic divergence arising from separation or isolation mentioned above in relation to early models of Indo-European languages. The third group of models is based on processes of a linguistic convergence. The wave model, formulated by Johannes Schmidt in the 1870s, is an example, but convergent methods have not generally found favors among linguists.
What is the fourth class?
The slow and rather static operation of these processes is complicated by another factor, linguistic replacement. That factor provides the basis for a fourth class of models. In many areas of the world, the languages initially spoken by the indigenous people have come to be replaced, fully or partially, by languages spoken by people coming from outside.
Just like American Indians hardly use their original language right now. They speak English instead.
Yes. Anyway, if this large complicating factor was not discovered, the world's linguistic history would be described by the traditional view of an language, followed by the gradual, long-term workings of divergence and convergence. So linguistic replacement also has a key role in explaining the origins of the Indo-European languages.
I quite agree. Well, Joanna, thank you for giving us so much information on the origins of Indo-European languages.
My pleasure.
Next week, we will have Professor Linda Smith from Oxford University to tell us the development of English in recent decades. I will meet you then at the same time. Bye-bye.
This is the end of part 2 of the interview. Questions 6 to 10 are based on what you have just heard. Question 6. What do linguistic family trees mainly indicate?
Question 7. How many classes of models are there in the development of languages?
Question 8. When did the wave model formulate?
Question 9. Which factor provides the basis for the fourth class of model?
Question 10. What does Joanna think of the linguistic replacement factor in explaining the origins of the Indo-European languages?